Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. It's September 6th. It's Tuesday after the long holiday weekend. And we're going to finish up Chapter 6 and move on to Chapter 3 today. And before we get started, I'm going to turn some of these lights down. But before we get started, we have a test scheduled for this Thursday. But I'm going to postpone it until a week from today. So you get to study over next weekend as well. So next time, if we're not through with chapter 3 today, we'll finish that up. But we might move on to the next chapter after that on Thursday. All right, so I'm not going to just stop because the test is coming up. Right, so we might proceed to the next chapter. And I forget what the next chapter is. Maybe it's 5. I'm not sure. Okay. All right, so last time we got together, we talked about membrane potentials, active transport versus passive transport, and a couple of different ways to think about active transport. What's the easiest way to think about active transport? It requires something, energy, okay? And one kind requires that ubiquitous energy molecule in your body. What's that? That is the energy currency that your cells run on. ATP, all right? So if there's an active transport process that requires ATP, what kind of active transport is that? That's primary active transport. So if we go back to maybe look at this slide right here, sorry for moving around, but here we have some active transport, and you see ATP being hydrolyzed to ADP and inorganic phosphate, right? It's moving sodium from low to high. It's moving potassium the opposite direction from low to high again, right? That requires energy in the form of ATP, so that's primary active transport. There's another active transport mechanism that's taking place that's just on the apical surface of this membrane right here. So we see glucose going from low to high concentration across the cell membrane. That requires some energy, but is this an example of primary active transport? And why would you say no? Because you don't see ATP on that diagram. And I certainly didn't ask you to draw it in, so that's a good clue. All right? Remember, so this is not primary active transport, but secondary active transport. Remember, there are two kinds, depending on, okay, which way these molecules are moving. And you always see two molecules moving for secondary active transport. If they're moving in the same direction, like sodium and glucose in this example, we would call this co-transport or symport, but sometimes molecules can move in opposite directions. What do we call that? Anybody know what that's called? Yeah, I'm glad I hear some answers out there. Counter-transport or what? Antiport. Either one works fine for me. And how do you know this is secondary active transport? No ATP being used, but nonetheless, there's something, namely glucose, going from low to high concentration. That requires energy. And if ATP is not the energy source, what is the energy source? It is what? The concentration gradient of sodium. So something has made the sodium concentration gradient, right, from high to low, and that energy can be used to drag glucose inside the cell. Okay, so that's some things about active transport. Then we talked about membrane potential. You should make sure you know what these four ions are that are primarily responsible for the membrane potential. You should know which ones are high on the outside, which ones are high on the inside. You should know in a resting cell, and this is all in a resting cell, what is the electrical charge on the inside of the cell compared to the outside? Okay, so slightly negative on the inside. And maybe you could follow that discussion on how that developed. All right, so if we have this, how did that develop? Here's an example. For instance, if we move these fixed ions out of the cell and forget about sodium, and we put zero concentration of potassium on the inside and high potassium on the outside and allowed potassium to move across the membrane, what would happen after a long period of time? What would be the concentration of potassium on the inside compared to the outside? Forget about these fixed anions right here. If the membrane was permeable to potassium. Okay? As far as diffusion is concerned, right, potassium would enter the cell until there was equal concentration of potassium, right? And then potassium would stop moving. So the concentration of potassium would be exactly the same. And what about the electrical charge? would be exactly the same too, right, if there were no fixed anions. But if we put a lot of negative charges inside the cell, they're not allowed to leave the cell, is that going to have any effect on potassium? Yeah, because what? They're opposite electrical charges. And what do opposite electrical charges do? They attract each other. So just by putting these fixed anions in there, that's going to have a tendency, what, to bring more potassium inside the cell, right? Not enough to neutralize this negative charge completely, because as we bring more potassium inside the cell, then we have higher concentration inside compared to outside. And what does that do? That's going to try to force potassium back out. So there's a new equilibrium that's established due to the chemical concentration of potassium, but also due to the, what, electrical difference across the membrane right here. So these two things will be acting oppositely, and when they're balanced out exactly, we call that the equilibrium membrane potential. And I think you have to know something about that, because you have the Nernst equation right here, right? So if you know, I'll give you the Nernst equation on the test, but you got to have a calculator, know how to use it. So for instance, if you know the concentration of ions on the outside and inside of the cell, you can calculate the equilibrium potential. Or if I give you the equilibrium potential, you could calculate what the ratio of these ions are on the inside and the outside. Because remember, this is at equilibrium, this equation makes sense, right? So you can calculate one or the other. Kind of reminds you of what kind of equation? Here's log to the base 10. Kind of reminds you of a pH equation, right? So if I give you the concentration of hydrogen ions, you can calculate pH, or if I give you pH, you can tell me what the concentration of the hydrogen ion is, right? So those equations are very, very similar. Okay, then lastly, we're talking about cell signaling, and cells communicate through each other, right? If they're nearby cells, right, either through a synapse, and a synapse can take one of two forms. Here is an electrical synapse that allows a sodium current or sodium ions to diffuse from one cell through this gap junction into a neighboring cell. And when sodium enters this neighboring cell down over here, right, it changes the electrical properties of this cell. And that's going to change the physiology, as we will see. So this is an electrical synapse. But much more common in your body are chemical synapses. So it's not a molecule or a charged ion. That's a little redundant, right? But a charged molecule, which is an ion, to move from one cell to the other, right? Here's a cell that's secreted by one in the local neighborhood, and that cell, this molecule, signaling molecule, diffuses to a neighboring cell, right? And then it's going to change the physiology of these neighboring cells right here. If these neighboring cells have what? If they can be sensitive to this signaling molecule, what do they have to have? They've got to have a receptor, right? And if this tissue down here has receptors to this signaling molecule, then we call it a target tissue, okay? All right, so here's just an example of a neurotransmitter that's a paracrine agent that just moves across this synaptic cleft right here. All right, that's a neurotransmitter because it's secreted by a neuron. Here is a little bit longer range control. Here is an endocrine gland secreting a hormone, which then gets picked up by the blood. That's distributed everywhere in your body by diffusion. And here are some target cells right here. So this, why is this a target tissue? Because it has a receptor, right? Okay, so that takes us to the last couple slides. All right, and remember, in our nice simple world that we have molecules that fit one of two important kinds of personalities. All right, what are the two major kinds of personalities a molecule can have, depending on what its structure is, how the chemical bonds are made, whether they are hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Right? It really is a major change in their personality. All right, so let's talk about a hydrophobic kind of molecule. Hydrophobic means what? Is afraid of water, wants to be in a lipid environment, right? All right, so here is a signaling molecule, and it's hydrophobic, doesn't like to dissolve in plasma very much, so there are proteins in the plasma that carry these molecules around and then release them, right? And this molecule, can it get through the cell membrane? And you should have an understanding why that is, because what's the very nice, simple way that you think of a cell membrane? phospholipid bilayer, right? So it's just a lipid bilayer right here. And so this hydrophobic molecule can diffuse through this lipid world right here in the inner part of the membrane and enter the cell, right? Where inside the cell you have a receptor for it. And how would you describe the binding of this little ligand molecule, the hormone, with the receptor? It's based on what? On this diagram, clearly you're going to see its shape, right? So here's a nice spherical little signaling molecule, and the binding site is going to be complementary, right? But also electrical charge might play a little role, but mostly it's shape. But if it's also electrical charge, and the electrical charges have to line up just exactly, right? They have to have the right shape as well, so that a negative charge will match up with a negative charge in this receptor. All right, so when this complex then, we have the receptor and ligand complex, it will diffuse into the nucleus, and then it's going to start protein synthesis, which is talked about in our next chapter. All right, and part of that process is making messenger RNA, and the messenger RNA can make more proteins, which will drastically change how this cell functions. All right, so these are hydrophobic regulatory molecules. The question would be, where do you find receptors for hydrophobic regulatory molecules? Are they inside the cell or outside the cell? They're up. Let's take a look. Hydrophobic is inside the cell because this molecule is not excluded from entering the cell. So these receptors are inside. Some examples would be lipid signaling molecules like steroid hormones, thyroid hormones, and even nitric acid can enter the cell. All right, what's the second personality? The molecules that like to dissolve in water and not lipid. So here we have a hydrophilic molecule, the signaling molecule. Can it get through the cell membrane? It's excluded because the cell membrane, right, has this inner lipid world right here. And so how on earth can this signaling molecule that's stuck outside the cell change the physiology inside the cell? It does it through some kind of transduction scheme. All right, so that's what we're going to look at really, really soon. And so there has to be a receptor on the outside of the cell. Doesn't do any good to be inside. All right, the hormone binds to the receptor. That receptor then causes the buildup of other messengers inside the cell, which go on to change the physiology of the cell. All right, and so those messengers that develop inside the cell are called second messengers. The ones that are trapped outside are first messengers. All right, and that's always going to be the case. So where do you always find a first messenger? Outside. Right? And if it binds to a receptor that is what? Extracellular on the plasma membrane, it can cause the buildup of second messengers inside the cell. And those are what we're going to call second messengers. So know where these are always located. But nonetheless, in order for the cell to respond to the first messenger, where does it have to have a receptor? On the cell membrane. Because remember, these guys can't get inside the cell. So here's a list of some second messengers. They can be ions, like calcium, for instance. All right. Now take a look at this calcium. Does it look like calcium can go through the cell membrane very easily, all by itself? I see some people shaking their heads no, and that's wonderful. Okay, but I want to know why you think that. Why do you know that? Why can't calcium enter the cell? Because it's charged, it's polar, which means it's what? Hydrophilic. It can't get through the lipid world at all, the inner part of the membrane. Cyclic AMP is another second messenger inside the cell. Okay, G proteins are another one. DAG is another one. And IPI3 is another kind of second messenger. And we're going to talk about these throughout the class, but you should at least be aware that you've heard of these things before. All right, so what I want to introduce you to is this class right here. It's a special transduction scheme that takes information that's outside the cell, transduces it to information inside the cell. It's using G proteins. All right, so they're part of a second messenger pathway. They contain three important subunits, and these subunits are going to be dissolved in the membrane or inside the cell themselves, and they're called alpha, beta, and gamma. You'll see how to write those little Greek letters down. Okay, and when a first messenger binds to the G protein coupled receptor, it's going to cause dissociation of these three subunits, which then can diffuse around on the surface of the membrane, and they can bump into other kinds of proteins that are in the cell membrane. It could be an ion channel. And when the subunits bump into an ion channel, it might close some of these ion channels or open them up, but somehow it's going to change the state of that ion channel. It could bump into an enzyme and turn it off, or bump into an enzyme and turn it on. Again, it will just change the function of that enzyme. And when it does that, it's going to change the physiology inside the cell. All right, so this is an important exam figure, right? So I think it's always a lot better for you to have an understanding, a nice graphical picture in your mind of what's happening right here. So what do I see with these little things right here? Yeah, just a cell membrane, plasma membrane. This is the outside, here's the extracellular side, here's the intracellular side. And then, so this is just the phospholipid bilayer, but what's a better model to analyze this slide with? What else do we see right here? We see a protein, okay, that's an integral protein. It's inserted into the membrane, and we can see it goes all the way across the membrane. On the outside of the cell, here is the receptor. So the regulatory molecule can bind to this receptor. And when it does, it's going to activate this G protein, which is down over here. So here's the receptor, different from the G protein. Here are the three subunits in the G protein. Here's one, here's two, here's three, but typically we call them what? Alpha, beta, and gamma, just one, two, three. These subunits become activated. They need an energy source. That energy source is guanosine triphosphate. And you're kind of familiar with this because you're familiar with its cousin molecule. What's the cousin molecule to guanosine triphosphate? It is adenosine triphosphate, almost identical, but a little different structural conformation. Right, this GTP can activate this complex because it can be hydrolyzed into GDP and inorganic phosphate. Right, and after the regulatory binds to the receptor, these subunits will dissociate from each other and also from the receptor molecule. So beta and gamma, as far as we know, always kind of stick together. This alpha subunit splits apart by itself. And these things now can travel right on the inner surface of the membrane and maybe even dissolved a little bit in the lipid layer right here. Right, so they're just going to move from an area of high concentration to low through the membrane, not actually get inside the cell, where they can bump into other proteins that are where? They're also dissolved in the membrane. So here's another transmembrane protein. We call it an effector because it's going to change something inside the cell. This could be an ion channel or an enzyme. Let's just say it's an ion channel. When the beta and gamma bumps into this ion channel, it can open it up, maybe allowing water to enter or ions to enter or other kinds of compounds to enter the cell. Okay. Another example might be when the alpha subunit is dissolving or floating around on the cell surface, right? It bumps into another kind of protein. And instead of a channel, this could be an enzyme. And that enzyme is going to allow the catalysis of different reactions to take place inside the cell. All right, so it could be an ion channel or an enzyme. And then after that activity carries on for a little bit, these things dissociate from the effectors and then recombine at the receptor right here. And then, right, this process can go over and over and over again. As long as you have GDP to activate this alpha subunit right here. All right, so that's a way of taking a first messenger, which is trapped outside the cell, right? And so maybe if this is an enzyme, for instance, then that will cause the buildup of, right, maybe DAG or IPE3, or the buildup of cyclic AMP inside the cell, which is going to change the activity of the physiology of the cell. Okay, so we're going to be looking at this scheme a lot. This is a highly conserved kind of signal transduction scheme. Pretty much all life forms on the planet use this to convert first messengers into second messengers. All right, so what can that be used as? If we see a scheme like this that's used by all life forms, what can that be used as? Think in terms of biology, not physiology. Going beyond the human condition. That can be used as evidence for evolution. Okay, if all organisms use the same kind of complicated biochemistry scheme, makes you wonder where it all came from. Okay, so it can be not proof of evolution, but evidence of evolution. Okay, so that's it for chapter 6. Who's got some questions? We should review some concepts for chapter 6. G protein coupled receptors. Let me go really fast. I've got two major parts to them. It's got the receptor molecule and the G protein. All right. Guess why we call this a G protein right here? Because it has to be activated by guanosine triphosphate in order for it to work. All right. So that's why it's called a G protein. So you got the receptor and then the G protein, and the G protein requires energy in the form of GTP. Okay, so that's it for this particular chapter. Right, let me stop this one. What happens if I say stop? No, that goes. I want to close the window, but I don't know where the button is. Ah, there it is. Oh, and I opened up the one I want, but it's down over here someplace. Chapter 6, lecture PowerPoints. Chapter 3, okay. Here we are, chapter 3. Maybe I'll try to make, oh, no, that's what I didn't want to do. I want to keep it small so I can see those control marks right there. All right, so most of this chapter is a review for you. Some parts are not, but some parts are review from anatomy. So we're going to go over these relatively quickly, I think. But here we have something. What is this thing right here? Yeah, it's a cell, but what's it a building block for? Okay, it's the structural and functional unit of life. All right, so in this class, as in even anatomy classes, I want you to know structural and functional units of something. As a matter of fact, in the previous chapter, we talked about the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. How do cells communicate with each other if they're close by? Through a synapse. And remember, you got two different kinds of synapses, so that's the structural and functional unit of communication. Here's the structural and functional unit of life. All right, if you want to understand something about life, you have to know a lot about this particular cell, the various components. All right, starting with the plasma membrane, which separates the outside world from the inside living world, and then all of these organelles inside the cell. So on the test, the week from today, I want you to be able to identify each of these organelles by their shape, but I also want you to be, if I give you the shape, I want you to tell me what its function is. Right, so I want to go over that today. So we're going to know all the different pieces right here. So there are three main components. This organization of things is a little bit funny. Plasma membrane, I like. All right, separates the outside non-living world with the living world on the inside. Everything on the inside of the cell is what we call cytoplasm. All right, and cytoplasm does include organelles, but it also includes something else. All right, remember, this is a solution. All right, so there's that other thing is the watery part inside the cell right here, besides organelles, we call that cytosol. So cytoplasm are organelles and cytosol put together. That's the best way to think of this cell right here. All right, so what makes a cell is that it should have cytoplasm, and it might not contain organelles, but if it has cytosol, then it has cytoplasm, and it's got to have genetic material. Genetic material in a human cell is surrounded by the plasma membrane. I'm not plasma membrane, but the nuclear membrane right here has some structural features like the plasma membrane, which is the cell membrane. So in order for this to be a living cell, it's got to have genetic material and cytoplasm. And indeed, this cell does. And where did this cell come from? Where did this cell come from? And this is true of all cells. Where do cells come from? Only other cells. All right, so you might be wondering, well, where did the first cell come from? You might have to take a biology class to get into that detail, but that's kind of the theory of life. Only living cells arise from other living cells today. All right, so the first organelle that we're going to look at is the plasma membrane, and you know a lot about this already. Because what is the simple model in your mind of a plasma membrane? It is just a phospholipid bilayer. And you see that on this slide? For sure. But we know that in life, plasma membranes are a little bit more complicated than just a phospholipid bilayer. What else do they have? Other pieces, like proteins right here. And there can be other molecules on the inside. Like here's a little cholesterol molecule. And remember, what kind of molecule is cholesterol? What's its personality? It's a lipid, so it's hydrophobic. So look where it hangs out, in the lipid part of the membrane right here, because that's where it's comfortable. So here's that little lipid world and the water world on either sides. There can be protein molecules that span the membrane, right? These are integral proteins. There are some proteins that might be just loosely affiliated with the plasma membrane on the outside, right? And there can be microtubules. These proteins can be channels, or maybe they can be enzymes, and maybe they can have little sugar modifications on them, right? And the branching pattern right here kind of acts like a fingerprint. And what could I do with all your fingerprints? If I had your fingerprint and your fingerprint and your fingerprint and your fingerprint, everybody's fingerprint in here, what could I use those fingerprints for? Just the shape of the fingerprints, I could identify you as being you, right? Well, these little branching patterns are very specific to your body. And if I know what the branching pattern is, I know it belongs to you. But if I have a branching pattern that looks a little bit different, then I know it doesn't belong to you. So these are little cell identifiers, and all the cells in your body have them. They're called antigens. And that just identifies a cell as belonging to your body. But if there's a cell that comes in from somebody else, maybe you get a transplant or a blood transfusion, these markers are going to be a little bit different, a little bit different shape. What does your body immediately know? That cell doesn't belong to your body. Okay, and what's it going to do? It's going to try to destroy it. Your immune system is going to try to reject or destroy that particular tissue, right? Even though we might know it's helpful for you, your body doesn't know that. In which case, then we have to give you some immunosuppressant therapy so that those cells can live on and do whatever they're going to do in your body. So we call these things antigens. Okay, and don't forget, this is a selectively permeable membrane. It excludes what kind of molecules from going across? Yeah, the water, the polar molecules. Okay, so you can have transporters, you can have enzymes, receptors, and identity markers in the plasma membrane right here. And what's the model in your mind that most aptly describes what this membrane is doing? Not the phospholipid bilayer, but the fluid mosaic model. Because this phospholipid bilayer is very fluid, just sits like on the surface of the water down under here. It's very, very fluid. But it has all these other proteins and sugars associated with it, changing the structure of the membrane. Okay, but what does that do? If the structure of the membrane changes, then the function is going to change as well, right? So every tissue type has different kinds of mosaic properties, these other things that are substituted into the membrane. And even on that one slide that you had to draw in lab, even on the cell, on the apical surface of a cell, you'll have different proteins compared to the basal region, right? You drew that out in lab, different kinds of transporters in different parts of the membrane. All right, so these proteins can be modified by sugars. They can be modified by lipids. It gives the cell surface here kind of a negative charge, and we talked about antigens already. Okay. So the cell membrane can change shape. Right, so here is like a white blood cell, and there are protein molecules that can push and pull on the membrane, can push and pull on proteins that are stuck into the membrane. We call those microtubules and microfilaments, right? So the cell can change shape. So for instance, here is a little particle that's outside the cell. The cell can surround this one, not every cell, but this particular white blood cell can surround this particle. Look at all those little antigens on the surface of the cell. Kind of looks like a bacteria to me. Doesn't belong in your body. So this macrophage recognizes this as being a foreign invader to your body, surrounds it, right? And then we'll engulf that particle and we'll fuse it with something else called a lysosome inside the cell. And a lysosome is a vesicle filled with digestive enzymes. And then it will break this bacteria down, and then the bacteria loses its infectious properties. So the process of moving things inside the cell by the forming of a vesicle around it is called endocytosis, bringing inside the cell. And if it's eating a solid particle like this bacteria, we call that phagocytosis. But if it is actually just bringing fluid in, we call that pinocytosis. Exocytosis is the reverse process, where something is in a vesicle inside the cell, and that vesicle is moved over to the plasma membrane. The vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, and now what was ever inside that vesicle is secreted outside the cell. So there are things that move these vesicles around. Those are microtubules and microfilaments. We find those microtubules inside these surface specializations on the cell. And the picture of your cell that you have didn't have any of these little specializations, but maybe you can remember from your anatomy book. Right, cilia are like projections coming off the surface of the cell. And in human cells, a cell doesn't have one or two of these things. It has hundreds or thousands of them. And because they have these microtubules in there, they can sweep, they can beat. Do I have a picture? Oh, here's some cilia right here. They can sweep and beat. Here's a cross-section of a cilium. And here you can see microtubules, and they slide over each other. So one side becomes really long, it bends over. When the other side bends over, it gets long on the other side. So cilia can sweep back and forth. So the function of cilia is for what? I just want one word. Yeah, motility. Oh, wrong way. Motility. Right? So ciliated cells in our body don't swim around, but some unicellular organisms swim around their environment using cilia. All of our cells are fixed in place, like the lining of the trachea. So these cilia are sweeping mucus and dust particles that get trapped in our trachea so it doesn't plug up our lungs. Which way does all this mucus with dust particles and pollen get swept? All the cilia are sweeping up, right? Up out of your lungs, otherwise your lungs would plug up. Okay, flagella is similar to a cilia. It has microtubules, but it could be maybe 10 times longer. And there's only one human cell that has a flagellum, and it's a sperm. So it's a freely movable cell, human cell. It moves around by its single flagellum. All right, some unicellular organisms might have more than one, right, but they pretty much just act as a flagellum. So motility. Another surface specialization is microvilli. These are even smaller than the cilia. Right, these are not important for motility because they don't sweep or beat. They just make the surface area of a cell bigger. So here, if we have a cell, okay, and maybe here is an apical surface if this is flat. Here's another cell next to it if it has all of these microvilli on them. Okay, so let me try to make this distance the same. Right here to here is the same distance. All right, but if we really look at the surface area of this little line that I drew, how would we want to compare it with this segment over here? We want to flatten it out. All right, so if we pull it from end to end, what is the real distance or length of a cell that has microvilli on it? If we stretch it out, okay, it's going to be a lot longer. It's just a way of putting a way for material to move it across the cell membrane, because here is a much bigger membrane, but doing what? Fitting it into the same space. So microvilli fold the cell up, and that increases membrane transport or absorption across the cell membrane. So three different functions for these different specializations right here. Okay, cytoplasm and organelles. So don't forget, cytoplasm is made out of cytosol and organelles. Put them together, that is cytoplasm. So I like that definition a lot. Inside the cell has a certain shape. Like, what kind of shapes are you familiar with cells? Oh, speak up just a little bit. What kind of shapes are you familiar with? How about squamous, right? Does that ring a bell? Yeah, what's another kind of shape? Columnar, cuboidal. These cells have that particular shape because there's an internal skeleton inside those cells, right here, made by microfilaments and microtubules that are spaced with inside the cell. All right, and they're attached to the cell membrane, and they can push and pull on the cell membrane, giving that cell its particular shape. But that cytoskeleton also holds organelles inside the cell in a certain location. But it can also move organelles around inside the cell, like it can move a vesicle from near the nucleus over to the plasma membrane. So it does a lot of things, not just giving the cell shape, but it's also important for transportation. So think of the microtubule system inside the cells like being a little monorail where things can hop on, right, and be moved from one part of the cell to the other. So now what are you thinking? Maybe you were there over the weekend. Disneyland has a monorail, right? You can hop on it. It's just what a single track that can move people around from one place to another. All right, so here is that picture of a cell. Unfortunately, it doesn't have cilia, it doesn't have microvilli or flagella, but you could draw it on there if you wanted to. All right, so here are all the organelles. So I do want you to identify them and know something about them and be able to give me some information on what the function is. All right, so a lysosome. Let's see, going back over here, here's a lysosome right here. On the inside, we said, what does a lysosome contain? Digestive enzymes, like lysozyme. So a lysosome is an intracellular digestive system. It breaks things down that shouldn't be inside the cell, maybe a harmful particle, or maybe it's a big biomolecule that your cell wants to get its hands on the building blocks of. It's a way of breaking that biomolecule down into its building blocks. So here's a lysosome. Okay. Peroxisome is another kind of vesicle. Just a little bubble. It's a membrane-bound organelle, just like a lysosome is. So when we say membrane-bound, if we look at this vesicle right here, it has what? Just a phospholipid bilayer, just like the plasma membrane does. Then maybe it doesn't have a lot of other kinds of proteins associated with it. Okay, it's just maybe a phospholipid bilayer. But a peroxisome doesn't contain digestive enzymes. It contains other kinds of enzymes that can detoxify toxic compounds in our body. And one important organ that does that is the liver, so they're loaded with peroxisomes. It contains an enzyme called peroxidase. All right, so anytime you hear that term with an ASE on the end of it, that means that it's an enzyme which promotes some kind of chemical reaction. So a peroxisome for detoxification, that's the bullet word I want you to know. Mitochondria. All right. If we look at mitochondria, I see membranes. Most organelles inside of a cell have a membrane around them, and the membrane around a mitochondria is kind of complex because it's not just one membrane. There are two membranes. It's a membrane inside a membrane. And maybe some of you have taken a microbiology class. When you look at this thing inside the cell, it looks like a bacterium. Okay. And as a matter of fact, if we look even more closely, I can't quite see it in here, this mitochondria has its own genetic material. It has a chromosome, just like all the cells in your body have a chromosome. So here is something that has genetic material. It has a cell membrane, and it's got cytoplasm. What do we call something that has genetic material, cytoplasm, and a plasma membrane? A cell. So this is indeed a living cell. It fits all the definitions of a living cell and looks exactly like a bacteria. And these things live in all of our human cells, all right? So you might ask why they are there. Why is this bacterium living inside human cells? Because it's making ATP. Is ATP important for us? Absolutely. How much ATP do we need? Did I talk about that? I'm sure I did. You need what? About half your body weight every day of, in ATP to stay alive. And we get that ATP mostly from mitochondria. They're happy to give it to us. All right, as long as we give them oxygen and glucose, they give us ATP. All right, so also, if the cell runs low on mitochondria, it controls its own replication rate. So if there are not enough mitochondria inside the cell, this guy will divide, and it's not really a guy or a gal. It doesn't have a sex. Mitochondria asexual, like all bacteria are asexual. Right, then it will just reproduce itself so that it can make more ATP. So this is like a foreign organism living inside our cells. And what do we call it when two organisms live together in close proximity and they both affect each other in a positive way? They both enhance each other's life. That is symbiosis, right? So that's a symbiosis. So it's a symbiotic relationship. And we call this an endosymbiont right here because it's not living like on the outside of us, it's actually living inside of ourselves. Okay, so that's the endosymbiont theory. And when you see that term theory right here, since this is a science class, what does that mean? It's generally accepted by all scientists in the field. Right, so that's not a hypothesis. It's been shown and proved and thought about and talked about and discussed thoroughly to where everybody now understands this to be like a free-living bacteria inside our cells. But if it's a symbiosis, not only do human cells get something out of the deal, but the mitochondria has to get something from it too. What does the mitochondria have for giving up its freedom from living out in the outside world, from living inside human cells, or other kinds of mammalian cells? What does the mitochondria? What's such a good deal for mitochondria? Ah, it gets protection. That's right. It can't be infected by viruses. It can't be eaten by other kinds of bacteria. Right? It uses the human immune system to protect it. And what's the other thing? Is that it gets oxygen and it gets nutrients. Right? So that is the nice symbiotic theory right there. So you got to know, what's the function of this mitochondria right here? Power supply of the cell, produces ATP. Okay, but don't forget, it's really a functional integral part of the cell. Human cells can't live without it. And as a matter of fact, this mitochondria can't live without a human cell, so they fused into basically a new life form. Ribosomes, the function of a ribosome, kind of looks like a sphere right here with a tunnel running through it. It's an RNA molecule. It's made of RNA, just a few proteins in there. You remember the building block of RNA? RNA stands for ribonucleic acid. So this is made up of what? Ribonucleotides, right? So it's a kind of nucleic acid. And it's got two subunits. These are very, very small particles. Can't really see them with a light microscope. But, oh, if we go back to mitochondria right here, all these little dots are ribosomes. Okay, and the function of a ribosome is that it's the workbench for making a protein. So protein synthesis is an important function of this ribosome. And where did we see these ribosomes? In the nucleus or cytoplasm? Cytoplasm, right? So they're in the cytoplasm. They're not inside the nucleus. There can be two places where you find them, associated with endoplasmic reticulum right here, or they can be free ribosomes in the just floating around in the cytosol. In every case, they're going to make a protein, but the fate of those proteins will change drastically. Right? If it's a free ribosome, those proteins will stay inside the cell, but if it's a protein made by rough endoplasmic reticulum, its fate is to be secreted outside the cell. We'll see how that happens in just a little bit. All right, so if I ask you the function of this ribosome right here, or these ribosomes here, you're going to say protein synthesis. It's the workbench for making a protein. Ooh, what's the building block of a protein? Amino acids, that's right. So these ribosomes need amino acids. We'll see where they come from in a little bit. All right, so endoplasmic reticulum is another membrane system inside the cell. It's very extensive. And you can see there are two forms. Here's smooth ER, and then here's rough ER. Rough ER has ribosomes attached to it. So what's the function of rough ER? Protein synthesis. All right, what about smooth ER? Can it make a protein? No, because it doesn't have ribosomes. It makes other things, namely lipids. All right, so rough ER is for protein synthesis, smooth ER is for lipid synthesis or steroid synthesis or inactivation or activation of lipid kinds of compounds. Endoplasmic reticulum has a tendency to conform around the shape of a nucleus, so you can tell that it's endoplasmic reticulum. Right? It's a phospholipid bilayer with maybe sometimes organelles stuck to it. Here's another membrane system. We call it Golgi apparatus or Golgi body. All right. I forget who Signor Golgi was. Okay, I got it on my calendar upstairs. But sometimes organelles or other things are named after people that discovered them or described them. All right, so that's why this term right here starts with a capital G, because it was named after somebody. That's always one good way to tell. And the Golgi apparatus will receive proteins made by rough ER, right? And here's a protein that's made by the rough endoplasmic reticulum. It's stuck inside the ER, and then it gets put into this little vesicle. You can see it pinching off from the rough ER right here, and then it hops a ride on a microtubule system to this apparatus. And inside the Golgi apparatus, see these proteins now inside the Golgi apparatus right here, they can become modified, right? Maybe the protein can be broken down into smaller pieces, or it can be added to a sugar, or maybe added to a lipid, right? So those would be lipoproteins or glycoproteins. So one function of the Golgi apparatus is modification of proteins. It can modify proteins, right? But what did we say? What was the nature of those proteins made by rough ER? What was the fate? I'm sorry, what was the fate? It was going to end up outside the cell. All right, so now they're inside the Golgi apparatus. Well, then they're packaged into another kind of vesicle, which can hop a ride on a microtubule, move over to the plasma membrane. And remember, the membranes of all these vesicles are the same, just a phospholipid bilayer, so it can fuse with the plasma membrane, and now those modified proteins can be secreted from the cell. A really good example might be like a goblet cell, which secretes mucus, and mucus is just a modified protein. It's a protein with a sugar molecule added to it. It's what we call a mucopolysaccharide. Okay, so this pathway of proteins being made in rough ER, moving through the Golgi, right, and being transported by vesicles, and then from the Golgi transported by vesicles to the outside of the cell, this is what we call the secretory pathway. So you need all of those organelles to do it. Oh, and then here's a nice pretty micrograph. I can see some free ribosomes in here, a bunch of other vesicles tracking around. Okay, but these other proteins could be what, like peroxidase? For instance, if it was a peroxisome, or it could be lysozyme, if it's a lysosome. Okay, so different kinds of vesicles. There's one other kind of vesicle. Ooh, I don't know if I have it on this slide. I don't want to go flipping through there. But make sure that I remind you of something called an endosome. All right, so you got peroxisome, lysosome, and endosome. And if I don't have a slide, make sure I cover what an endosome is. I do want to define that, because your book is just a little bit weak in this chapter, but it's strong in other chapters, so you do have to know about them. All right, so here is another membrane-bound organelle inside the cell. Here's the nucleus. We see the nuclear envelope right here. Oh, I see some ribosomes on the outside. I really don't see any ribosomes on the inside. So it's got a double wall right here. It's got an inner and outer membrane. Kind of reminds you of the mitochondria a little bit, okay? And indeed, here's a similarity. It does contain some genetic material. As a matter of fact, really all the genetic material that determines the structure and function of this cell and, of course, then of your body. And then it has some big pores to allow some big molecules to move across the membrane. The function of this membrane right here is to protect all the genetic material inside the nucleus, because genetic material is a very long, thin, filamentous molecule. And it can be easily damaged. And you can't really cut those molecules apart and splice them back together again very easily without changing the information right there. All right, so think of this genetic material as like a computer program that you're using inside your computer. What happens to that computer program if it gets corrupted? What happens to the program? Stops working. What do you have to do? Reload software, all right? So hopefully you have a backup of that software, in which case you can get going again. But this cell doesn't have a backup copy. If this information gets damaged, guess what happens to the cell? It croaks, that's right. It's dead, right? So this information is protected by the nuclear envelope. That's one of the major functions of the nuclear envelope right here, all right? But it's also continuous with the endoplasmic reticulum. Some small molecules can diffuse through this pore. But proteins, these large molecules, proteins and RNA must be actively transported using ATP right here through these pore complexes. All right, some more background information. Gene expression. Well, where do we find genes? Kind of flows from the last section, because genes are contained in the chromosomes. And where do we find chromosomes? Inside the nucleus. They're protected by the nuclear envelope. So do you find chromosomes out in the cytoplasm anytime? You don't. They're always behind this envelope being protected. If they're out in the cytoplasm, then that information can be lost. It can be damaged, and then the cell's going to die. Okay. So here is just a general scheme. This is a good place for you to start, maybe not through your whole career, but here is what biologists call the central dogma of biology. It's information flow. And information flows from DNA. Where did we say we find DNA all the time? Inside the nucleus, right? Then DNA is converted into RNA, and then RNA can be actively transported from the nucleus into the cytoplasm. Okay, so RNA can be in the nucleus or in the cytoplasm. It's active in the cytoplasm. It's not really active inside the nucleus. That's why it has to get into the cytoplasm. Now, this is what we call protein synthesis, because proteins are being made from the information that's contained in DNA. Right? So where is all the information in your cells that can be used to make a protein? Where do we find it? In the nucleus, yeah, it's right inside the nucleus. And how many step process is it to take information that's in DNA and make a protein out of it? How many steps does it take? And if you look at this slide, how many arrows do you see? It's a two-step process, right? And we're going to know the names of these two steps. Furthermore, what can you tell me about these two steps? Can information flow backwards and forwards? No, it can only flow in one direction, right? Information flows from DNA into a protein, never the reverse direction. You might have to modify some of these concepts, you know, in the upcoming years as we become more aware of these kinds of things, okay? But this is a really good place to start. Right, so information in DNA always flows from DNA into proteins, never the reverse. And that's really handy. That's really reassuring. Because, for instance, tonight when you go and cook some chicken on the barbecue tonight, right, and eat some chicken proteins, you don't ever have to wake up in the morning with what? Feathers in a beak. Because the proteins that you eat can't change who you are. That information, there's information in those proteins, but it can't be converted to change your DNA. All right, so that's an important process. All right, so the two steps for protein synthesis. All right, the first step is what we call transcription. That's when information in DNA is made into information in RNA. So what the heck is transcription? Anybody have an idea of transcription? You're probably pretty familiar with transcription. You've used that all the time. It's a copy. Consider it a photocopy, right? So if you're applying for a job or another school someplace, they want to see what kind of work you did at Cypress College, you call administration and records and ask for a photocopy, okay, which is what? A transcript. So they're just transcribing that information. Is any information lost? No, it's almost an exact copy, right? And how do we know this is transcription, DNA to RNA? What's the language of DNA? What's the building block of DNA? It's a nucleotide, right? What's the building block of RNA? It's a nucleotide as well. Small modification, okay, just add one oxygen group, but basically it's the same language because it's using the same building blocks or nucleotide language. Okay, so that's transcription. Where does that take place? Inside the nucleus, because DNA never leaves the nucleus. Remember that? All right, then what happens to RNA? Gets transported out through the nuclear envelope into the cytoplasm, and this is where the second step takes place, where the information in RNA is converted into a protein. We call this translation. All right, so why on earth do we call this translation? These are awfully big words, but transcription wasn't too hard to appreciate. What about translation? Okay, what does translation do? Say I'm talking in Farsi. Who understands Farsi in here? Not very many people. You wouldn't get much out of the lecture. What would you need? A translator to translate my speaking Farsi into whatever language you understand. We're doing pretty good with English so far, okay? Yeah, so a translation takes information that's in one language and converts it into another language. Now, what about the information? Would you pay your translator if they took my information that I was speaking in Farsi into different information and presented it to you in English? No, I would fire that person, right? You'd never pass the test. What about the information in the two languages? Languages are different, but the information is what? Exactly the same, okay? So that's what we call, that's why we call this translation, because the building block or the language of RNA is a nucleotide language. What's the language of proteins? Amino acids, two different languages right here, all right? So there has to be some kind of translation program that does that. We'll look at that in a little bit. Now, where does this step take place? In the cytoplasm, right? Transcription in the nucleus, translation in the cytoplasm. All right, so translation just takes the spelling using nucleotides in RNA, and it spells out a protein. And the spelling is made by, what, different amino acids that make a protein. And it's just a linear sequence. Okay, and the linear sequence in amino acid then can be translated, what do we call that? Just a linear sequence of amino acids. It's this kind of structure of that protein. We call that the primary structure. Primary structure because the nature of the molecule can be used to cause different foldings, and that's called secondary structure, like the alpha helix or beta pleated sheet. And all those little different foldings then can cause, what, a certain three-dimensional shape of that protein molecule, which is tertiary structure. And then if those things have the proper shape, then you can put different protein strands together, right? That would be the quaternary structure. So each of those levels of structure are necessary to build upon each other. You could think of them as building blocks. Okay. So what the heck are genes? So genes are lengths of DNA that code for the synthesis of RNA. And one kind of RNA will be messenger RNA that carries that message from the nucleus into the cytoplasm and tells how to build a particular protein. Now, where is a protein made? What's the workbench for a protein in the cytoplasm? A ribosome, okay. So a ribosome not only needs amino acids, but it has to know how to put them together in the proper order, and it gets that information from the messenger RNA. Okay, two-step process. I guess we talked about this already. Okay. So inside the nucleus, you might have noticed the dark area. We call that the nucleolus. Usually a nucleus only has one of these areas, but it could have more than one. Right, that's the active part of the nucleus where transcription is taking place. In particular, right, it's a heavily active area for making ribosomal RNA. And did I mention what the function of ribosomal RNA? What does it make? It makes the pieces for a ribosome. Okay, so it makes the workbench for making a protein. So ribosomal RNA is being made in the nucleolus, which is the active part of the nucleus. All right, so genes code for all these different things, especially the messenger RNA. And if we think of all the different genes that are contained in a cell, we call that the genome. And it's just a finite number of pieces of information on how to make a protein. But a genome are the genes, and it makes proteins, so you could think of all the proteins that a cell can make. And that's what we call the proteome. Right? So the proteome is determined by the genome. The genome is like the building block of the proteome right here. So genome refers to just a set of genes that your cell has, and the proteome is the set of all proteins that can be made by those genes. All right, so let's take a look. Let's analyze some genetic material. So genetic material is arranged on a chromosome. So here I have a chromosome, and it's a replicated chromosome, and it's very thick and dark. You can see this with a light microscope. This right here is what we call condensed chromatin. So the genetic material is really a long, long fiber, which we call chromatin. Sometimes it can be packaged in a very safe form that we call a chromosome, and we can see it. So a chromosome not only contains genetic material, but proteins as well. Some of those proteins are what we call histones. So here is a histone. It kind of reminds me of a little spool or a bobbin that thread can be wound up on. So here is chromatin that's wound up on a histone molecule. And when you have genetic material on a histone, we call that a nucleosome. And then nucleosomes can be packaged together, kind of wound up, and then wound up again, these super coils of genetic material, and then finally it's packaged into this chromatin. So this is what we call condensed chromatin, and when it's unwound from all the histones right here, we call this extended chromatin. So you can see how long this molecule is because it's wound up and then wound up again and wound again and then even wound some more and even wound up a whole lot more. So each chromosome contains a very long distance of genetic material. As a matter of fact, if we take all the cells in your body and take the extended chromatin and end it up and just place it end to end, that would be enough to reach 250,000 miles, which is the distance to the moon. Okay, and indeed you have lots of cells in your body, but still that kind of shows you how much information is contained in all the cells of your body. All right, so here is extended chromatin, here is condensed. And I can see the nucleotides right here and right here. What kind of nucleotides are these? Are these ribonucleotides or deoxyribonucleotides? Deoxyribonucleotides, because this is DNA. Okay, it tells you on the slide it's DNA, but how else can I know that this is DNA? Because I see two strands, right? So DNA is always double-stranded. RNA, only rarely is it double-stranded. It is mostly single-stranded. All right, so just to review, nucleic acids have a backbone of what? Phosphate sugar, and then an interior part consisting of the bases. And for DNA, it would be what? Guanosine, cytosine, adenine, and thymine, if we were to look. And notice they have the proper shape so that they fit together right here. So extended is the kind of genetic material that can be used for transcription. But it's really long and narrow. And so if it's a really long, narrow molecule, do you think it's fragile? As opposed to something thick and bulky. Yeah, it can be damaged. So if the genetic material is extended form, it can be used for transcription, but it can be easily damaged. All right, so what's the best way to protect this DNA? Is to wind it up on these proteins and put it in a chromosome. If it's condensed chromatin, it's very safe. It can't be damaged, but what's the trade-off right there? It can't be used for transcription, can't be used to make a protein. All right, so when under certain circumstances, the nuclear envelope disappears, the genetic material can be damaged, but before that happens, extended chromatin is packaged into condensed chromatin to protect it. All right, so I kind of think of that as like going on a trip sometime. All right, would be nice if I had a really fast airplane. I could have gone to like Bali over the weekend. All right, go do some scuba diving or something, surfing. All right, so suppose I went to Bali for a vacation. Would I walk on the airplane with my toothbrush and my comb and my swimming trunks and my swim fins and a mask and bathing suit? What else would I need? Sunblock. Would I walk onto an airplane like that? What would I do with all that junk? I put it in a suitcase. I protect it, right? But if my sunblock is in the suitcase, can I use it? No, it's protected. I can't lose it. Can't lose my sunglasses, but I can't use it. All right, in order for me to use it, I got to do what? I got to get it out of the suitcase in order for me to use it. But if I take my sunglasses out of the suitcase, what could happen to them? I could sit on them, I could lose them, I could forget them, right? Could be damaged. All right, if that happens to a cell, the information in a cell, then don't forget the cell dies as a result. So here is extended, here is condensed chromatin. All right, so my definitions are a little bit different than your book, okay? Your book says euchromatin is part of the chromosome that is active. I call that extended. Heterochromatin is condensed into chromosomes. And it looks darker so that you can see it with a light microscope. Your book says that heterochromatin is permanently inactivated. That probably is not always true. I want you to think of heterochromatin as being condensed. It is inactive, but it might not be permanently inactivated. There are parts of chromosomes that are permanently inactivated depending on various things that we do to our body. And it might even stay permanently inactivated for a generation or two. We don't really know. So that's kind of interesting because our behavior now can change, we realize, can change the genetic makeup of our offspring, which is kind of fascinating how that might help happen because of the way that certain parts of chromatin can become activated. So activation and inactivation of chromosomes is very important for us to know something about because that's going to change the physiology inside the cell. So here I have condensed chromatin that's making up a chromosome. All right. In order for it to be used, what has to happen to it? It's got to become extended. All right. And the way that cells signal that is that there is an enzyme that acetylates this supercoil right here and it starts to unwind. So acetylation causes the unwinding of condensed chromatin into extended chromatin and now it can be used. All right, so acetylation is a control process. Here is the beginning of a gene, and this segment right here we call a promoter region, sometimes has to have what we call a transcription factor. It has to bind to this region right here before this next segment can be transcribed. All right, so a transcription factor is like a signal that causes transcription of this gene right here. It can't happen with condensed chromatin, only extended chromatin. Right, and when the cell has enough of this RNA produced, then it's going to inactivate this. Why does it want to inactivate this region right here? A couple reasons. One is to, what is this like up here? Stable, it's protected, right? The cell doesn't want this lying around because it can be damaged. Right? So the way that it goes from extended chromatin back to condensed chromatin is that it is deacetylated. And an acetyl group is just a two-carbon fragment. We're going to look at that in a couple chapters. So you could just say carbon-carbon right here. When it's added to this group, right, it becomes extended. When that two-lone carbon fragment is taken off, then it forms this nice protected, compact, condensed chromatin right here. So that's a very important way that gene expression is controlled. Okay, so what's the first part of protein synthesis called again? The first part, where does that take place? Transcription happens in the nucleus, right? And it's the synthesis, it's converting converting DNA into RNA. All right, so one gene codes for one polypeptide chain, and each gene has several thousand nucleotide base pairs long. All right, so there is a compound that's going to look at DNA and convert it into RNA. And remember, RNA is just made up of subunits of ribonucleotides put together, just a polymer. What kind of reaction is that when you take small units and put them together? Dehydration synthesis, right? All the way back, nothing real special. The enzyme that performs dehydration synthesis using ribonucleotides is RNA polymerase, right? So polymer is just a big long molecule with repeating subunits over and over again. And so a polymerase is just an enzyme that makes a polymer. It has to bind to a start sequence in DNA. And what can you tell me about DNA? Is it single-stranded or double?
Double-stranded.
The information for transcription, if the strands are together, is locked away. So the molecule has to unzip. RNA polymerase can unzip the strands. Now, does that require a lot of energy? What can you tell me about the bonds that hold the two strands of DNA together? They're weak because they're hydrogen bonds. So it's easy to unzip DNA, and then it's easy for it to zip back up together again. So DNA polymerase doesn't need a whole lot of energy. It's got to bind to the promoter region, and there's got to be a transcription factor that says that this product is necessary for the cell. Okay, and then RNA is made. So how's it made? Here's DNA. How do you know this is DNA right here?
Double-stranded.
What's another way? A little bit more molecular way. Here's a thymine right here, because there are no thymines in RNA, so this is DNA for sure. All right, so here the polymerase unzips these molecules, the two strands, and then it starts to base pair. All right, so it's going to use the DNA strand, one of the DNA strands, as a template for making the RNA molecule. So what's going to base pair with guanine? So here is the DNA. So it's going to place a cytosine RNA nucleotide right here. And what's going to base pair with cytosine? Guanine, right? And here's adenine and DNA. That's going to base pair with, and since this is RNA, it can't base pair with thymine. It's got to base pair with uracil instead, which is what? Just a small modification. These cytosines and guanine are exactly the same except for what? It's a ribose instead of a deoxyribose. All right, so this right here, this strand, is used as a template to make almost an identical strand of RNA. All right, so if you wanted to make 1,000 shirts all the same size, what would you use? A pattern or a template, right? So this DNA can make thousands of these RNA molecules, and they're going to be all exactly the same based on what the sequence of nucleotides that are in DNA. All right, when the RNA polymerase gets to the end of this gene, all right, there's a stop signal, and it breaks away, and this RNA is then free to move around. Okay, it's going to move into the cytoplasm, and then the DNA molecule zips back up. Okay, so I guess we're going to start here next time talking about these different kinds of RNA that are made. Okay, we've got three major kinds of RNA: messenger, transfer, or ribosomal RNA. All right, so if you came in late, you might be ready for the test on Thursday, but the test is not on Thursday. The test is a week from today. Okay? Okay, so I'll try to get these lectures up soon. All the other lectures are online, but I'll try to get this one up maybe before the weekend. Like what's in the back of the book. And some examples that I made.